prosecutes, you know, who he feels are against him. What can we do, Francisco? How can we do the pushback?
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned power, that the fact is, of the matter, it's been so beautiful to see the power of people united, people organizing. Folks could still go to adoptacornersf@gmail.com, adoptacornersf@gmail.com, and there, it doesn't matter what city you're in, we can reroute you to the correct area where you would like to participating in the activity Adopt a Corner. At the Latino Task Force in San Francisco or the Immigrant Defense Committee in Oakland Bay Area, through this email as well, adoptacornersf@gmail.org, you can connect in ways that you can support. And this is what has to continue to happen for us to come together and continue to organize and continue to work together. Thank you. I'm sorry, I've gone too long here, but it is beautiful to see the level of organizing that's going on in our communities.
Okay, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
Down by the river, where the rain runs cold, there's a frog in Portland, brave and bold. He don't carry signs, he don't throw stones, just hops on the line with a megaphone.
ACLU Oregon has been litigating and advocating to take on ICE and Border Patrol abuses and violations. Join me on Prison Pipeline, March 2nd, 6:30 p.m. to hear Sandy Chung from ACLU Oregon about how ACLU is protecting our immigrant communities and upholding all our civil liberties. That's Prison Pipeline, March 2nd, 6:30 p.m.
Ribbit, 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 let freedom sing. It's a funny old way to do your thing. With a smile and a hop, you can make your stand in a frog suit holding freedom's hand. With the chicken, the shark, and the unicorn parade, we all march proud in the Frog Brigade.
We're awfully close to a real civil war these days. Is it possible that young people, the young generation, might be the ones to pull us through and make America America again? Stay with us. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
In Michael Kazin's important 2022 book, What It Took to Win, he scans the last 150 years of American history or so to discover what the key factor was in the years when Democrats or liberal Republicans won their elections. As it turns out, in each case, there was a movement below the efforts to just win the elections. Think about some of the successful movements in electoral gains since the 1890s. The farmer movement for paper currency, the movement for clean food production, an end to child labor, women's right to vote, the union movement, civil rights movement, and of course the anti-war movement of the Vietnam era. Today we see a rising movement against the violent authoritarianism and thuggery of ICE and Homeland Security. What may be a thread linking all these successful movements was young people, many of whom were not old enough to vote but had the unique power to shape future elections. And what's on the immediate agenda is nothing short of stopping the destruction of our democratic republic. The orange one in the White House is determined to cleanse America of all he doesn't desire, be they people of color, LGBTQ people, undocumented immigrants, trans people, anyone Trump can't stand. Young people have a unique role as the vanguard of this movement to keep America America. On this Keeping Democracy Alive, returning guest, the Reverend Liz Thea Harris, and her nibbling, Sam, an organizer in their own right, explore an underappreciated reality in this century, how young people have been showing up in a remarkable fashion to deal with our growing problems and offer bold new solutions. As Tom Engelhart of Tom Dispatch magazine puts it, if we know anything from decades of anti-poverty organizing, it's that the unfettered imaginations, moral clarity, and capacity for decisive action of young Americans can always triumph over the misguided political liaisons of their elders. As our communities struggle righteously to wrest this nation from the clutches of full-throated authoritarianism, isn't it time to cultivate the untapped might of these potentially dispossessed generations? End of quote. Liz Thea Harris, our guest, certainly thinks so. Liz Thea Harris is a theologian and an ordained minister, an anti-poverty activist, director of the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice, and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. She's the co-author of the new book, You Only Get What You Organize to Take, Lessons from the Movement to End Poverty, and author of Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. Her article asking, Can the Young Wrest This Nation from the Clutches of Full-Throat Authoritarianism? Appears in Tom Dispatch, Counterpunch, and Portside. Doing some research for this discussion, I had a vague memory of something from the early 1960s, something called the Children's Crusade. It happened on May 2nd, 1963. If you would, please, tell us about that and its ripple effect on the civil rights movement.
Well, indeed, young people have been in the forefront far before the 60s, but that is a particularly important turning point in the Black freedom struggle. I think of it, I had a book that I read to my children who are teenagers now, that's called The Youngest Marcher. And it was about a 9-year-old who participated in that Children's Crusade. Went to jail alongside of slightly older teenagers than herself, but made this point, you know, that even these young people would fill up the jail if they needed to, and study and learn there and commit to the struggle there, but you know, that moment, that campaign is in the midst of other struggles. It's when these very violent law enforcement officials are turning water and dogs on the older organizers, and the young people say, you know, let us play a role, let us show our leadership here, this is about our present and our future. And so I think that's a really important march, but then also, another level to that and layer to that organizing campaign.
So it sounds like young people seeing injustice done get fired up. Imagine that. They know what's right and what's wrong. What does being...
It's clearer, right? Somehow it's clearer sometimes.
Yeah, really.
Than older people.
What does it mean being young at this point in the second Trump administration?
Well, I mean, it's been generation after generation that has not been doing better than their parents, but this one in particular, we have right now, as SNAP cuts are starting, work requirements are being added to food benefits, and the 2 in every 5 SNAP recipients are children, are young people. Young folks that are graduating from high school and from college are graduating into a crisis, a crisis of a weakening economy, a crisis of the lack of healthcare and adequate food and housing. Folks are now, not just moving back with their parents if they leave for college,
right.
But actually delaying having children of their own. The conditions, the economic and social political conditions. I mean, folks in Generation Z and Generation right. Alpha have not known a time when we are not at war. They have not known a time when the climate was going to be okay. They've not known a time when the prospects of their lives and livelihoods are flourishing. And, you know, that takes a toll on those generations, but it also spurs folks to action.
They do. They know right from wrong. We've been told that, and now they can actually do something about it. It's been curious and frankly baffling and troubling to me, the appeal to young people, almost entirely young men, of something called Turning Point USA, the Charlie Kirk organization. What is that, and what is its appeal to young people, especially at this point in time? What kind of emotions does Turning Point USA tap into?
Well, so I think there is the emotions that they're tapping into, the creation of all kinds of media and social media and resources that you know, talk about being embattled, you know, try to create places of belonging. But, you know, that's happening at the same time as these crises where, you know, young people, including especially young men, are not secured a good future. And when many more progressive and other entities and institutions have really just kind of left the playing field, especially from high schools and colleges. And so Turning Point USA has been, you know, making up that ground and being some of the only kind of organizing and institution building that's happening on high school and college campuses. And, you know, they're growing very fast in the wake of the assassination of Charlie Kirk. I mean, they had a very ramified, very broad strategy that, you know, was just populating itself throughout all of social media. Just so much money poured in to kind of make meaning of this moment, talk about, you know, being someone and believing in something. And there really isn't an equivalent amongst more progressive people. And there needs to be. Part of why we launched this Young Organizer Survival Corps is to really be able to counter these extremist forces, these Christian nationalist forces, these politically violent forces that are really taking over the social media landscape, but also, you know, just shaping what generations of young people are seeing and hearing. It's not good. It's not good for people's well-being, for people's mental health, and it's not going to save these young people from some of the forces that are arrayed against them. Instead, you know, coming together across the lines that divide. Instead, you know, putting forth a vision of a just and abundant world for everybody. Instead, investing in education and culture and housing and healthcare for young people is what is needed right now. But instead, we have many forces that profit from and continue to propagate, you know, hate and division.
There's been a lot of hand-wringing on the left and the liberal side about what we can do to effectively counter the appeal of Turning Point USA. Can the populist left offer a counter appeal to them, and what might that look like, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think if we look at, for instance, the Super Bowl and uh-huh. the hundreds of millions of people that tuned in to watch Bad Bunny perform, to experience a show that lifted up the beauty and the power uh-huh. of Puerto Rican and Latin American culture. If we were to believe that the kind of extremists and hard right were the only people offering culture and vision and a place of belonging, we're wrong. Instead, Turning Point tried to organize this counter event with Kid Rock that had, you know, very few people turn in. And had all kinds of kind of technical difficulties. So I think that sometimes what's happening is that we should be definitely concerned about these forces of violence and of hate and their sophistication and their organization. But we should not confuse that with the fact that the vast majority of people in this country right now, and especially the vast, vast majority of young people, like, do not accept that kind of division and violence and hate. And instead, are celebrating diversity, are coming together right. across lines of division, and are holding out, you know, a true understanding of history, and then a path to lead us towards, you know, a world where everybody is in and nobody's out. And I think we saw this in the Super Bowl halftime show, but I think there's lots of instances of this, whether it's the young organizers that are out in Minnesota right now defending their families and their neighbors, or whether it's the young people that are held in Dilley Detention Center right now who have heard about other young people organizing and who have started to organize right there in the detention center. I mean, there are young people mm-hmm. all over the country right now, you know, rejecting this extremism, rejecting this hate. And I think we would do well to put some attention on that, because it's deeply hopeful. And we need some hope in these hard times.
And it seems to me a sense of belonging. I mean, there's this sense of isolation and depression that a lot of young people may have. I mean, it's not just young people that have that, but the Bad Bunny performance, and that's people together. That's got to be very appealing, I must say.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things that we've seen as the economy has tanked, as our society responded to the COVID shutdowns, not with expanding healthcare for all or expanding and extending the child tax credit, but cutting those off way too soon. I mean, I think what we've seen is that young people are looking for community, are looking for yes. togetherness, are looking for belonging, and they're finding it. But, you know, as our institutions kind of die, as public space is privatized, as like the job prospects for young people are worse and worse. I mean, I think these are hard times, but again, people are also responding all the time, finding space and creating community.
And there's also, frankly, the fun factor. Kids like to have fun. Adults like to have fun too, to a lesser extent. But being in a movement and being together with other people, dancing, celebrating, that's fun. It's contagious. And that can possibly serve as a counterweight to some of the Turning Point USA rigidity, maybe, I hope.
I think that's for sure. I mean, like at this boot camp that we had uh-huh. at the Alex Haley Farm, you know, in Tennessee, with about 100 young organizers from all walks of life, from all over the country. The last night, you know, folks organized just like a sweet kind of party and dance, and just, you know, came together and just had fun together, like you're saying. And I think, you know, we surely need joy. We surely need fun in these times. And I think communities that are being, you know, with their backs against the wall are pushing, and not just pushing for freedom and justice, but pushing for joy and fun as well.
Absolutely. I'm going to use a word here I had not heard before, but your nibbling Sam helped organize something called the Young Organizer Survival Boot Camp. Tell us about that, please, and about the term nibbling, I suppose. Describe the physical setting of the boot camp and what's unique about it. Do other movement people use the site as well?
Yeah, so Haley Farm is right there, kind of outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. It once belonged to Alex Haley, the amazing author.
Yes.
You know, both a creator of Roots and co-author of the autobiography of Malcolm X, amongst many other things. And in the 1990s, it became the property of the Children's Defense Fund, who have carried of organizing and justice making, and they still own that farm and welcome many different kind of justice struggles to use it. So we were there, about 100 people, young organizers from about 22 states, including Washington, D.C., who were coming from different struggles that they're leading in their communities, for those of them that were at college, from their campuses, you know, work around abortion, work around LGBTQ rights, work around immigration and immigrant justice, work around healthcare and housing and food access, and just so much. I mean, so many of the issues that are in front of us right now, there are young organizers really leading the way. And so folks gathered at Alex Daly Farm and had a chance to look at movement history and organizing strategies, what it takes to organize actions, how to bring ritual and art and culture and music, you know, into the struggle. Folks explored like themes like the battle for the Bible and the role that faith has played historically, is playing today in movements for justice and freedom and peace. And also just got to build really deep and broad connections with other young organizers who are organizing and leading in their respective areas. And so it was really powerful. I got to be there just for a day or so of it, but it was a week long. And now those young organizers are a part of this longer kind of program, where they're gathering and sharing experiences and learning together more, and also helping to lead, you know, actions and activities this spring and summer in their own communities.
So who is there a fund that helps pay for that? Because you want kids from all different walks of life there, and to spend, what is it, a week there?
Yeah, I mean, so we did some fundraising so that anybody that really wanted to be able to participate in this could do so without worrying about resources. But also folks were able to raise money from some of their campuses or their community organizations. I mean, one of the things we have found doing grassroots organizing work is that when you're organized, you're able to find resources. But we also are continuing to fundraise to be able to, you know, organize another boot camp, to be able to support young organizers over the summer to engage in movement building and organizing and as their kind of job and vocation. And so we need a whole lot more. We need a lot more space for young organizers to be able to come together and learn about organizing and movement building and politics and economics, and what our faith traditions say and don't say about, you know, justice. But you know, it felt like a really exciting start.
About how many kids were there? And I say kids because there are kids.
Yeah, so it was about 100 young people between the ages of 18 and about 30. And there was also an online gathering for folks that, for health reasons or for immigration status reasons, were not able to travel. And so, so we would love to be able to have other cohorts of young people to come through and connect and keep building together.
Well, let me ask now, and I'll ask later, if young people want to get in touch with this organization, is there some website you can point them to?
Well, folks can definitely connect with the Cairo Center, which is at Cairo Center NYC, on all the social media handles, and also just Cairo Center, KairosCenter.org, if folks want to check us out online, on the web. But really would be amazing for other young folks to connect and continue to build.
So is this the first year of it?
That's right. This was the first in January. This boot camp kicked it off.
Outstanding. Sounds like a lot of fun, I must say. I remember, you know, being young and being at a camp and how much fun it was to be with other young people and just, you know, interact without adults looking down your neck to see what you're up to. but just to have fun and be connected. You say you both learned, you and your nibbling Sam, learned new methods for and reasons to reclaim power, the power of our faith traditions. That sounds powerful. Tell us about that, please. What are some details, and how did the young people react?
Well, I think this one of the things that has happened, especially as Christian nationalism has gained more and more traction, is that there's almost an equal sign for many people, including young people, between extremism and hate and faith. When in actuality, if we look at the kind of history and rituals of many different faith traditions from across the world, they start with movement, with people that are being impacted by economic and social injustice, who with God on their side, say there has to be another way. And so it was a really important set of conversations and workshops that happened around the power of faith. And some of the folks that were present at this boot camp, came out of Jewish homes and Christian homes and other faith tradition homes. Some of them were still involved in churches and synagogues. There were folks from Jewish Voice for Peace, and some of the, Jewish, really powerful Jewish organizing that's been happening over the last couple of years. There were Muslim young people and others, but there also were many folks that have been very hurt by the kind of weaponization of religious imagery and scripture and text and tradition, against vulnerable communities, against LGBTQ folks, against immigrants. There is kind of a battle for the Bible raging in our society right now. I was hearing Mike Johnson say just the other day how there's a biblical basis for kind of law and order, right? Kind of justifying ICE running rampant in communities. And if we actually look at some of the advertisements that ICE has put out in recent weeks and months, and Homeland Security has put out, and the Department of War has put out, folks are using lots of religious imagery. I mean, one of the commercials to recruit new ICE agents, has this very famous part of the Bible where it says, "Here I am, send me." It's this text from Isaiah. It's usually a text that's used when someone's being ordained as a minister of the faith. And in this case, it's being weaponized to justify, asking people to sign up to be ICE agents to go and kind of violently tear down communities and separate families. Or Pete Hegseth, on the occasion of Charlie Kirk's death, put out this advertisement from, what he called the Department of War, the Department of Defense, where it's using the Lord's Prayer, this prayer that Jesus teaches in the Bible, and it's kind of interpreting it, quote unquote, with all of this imagery, and to show that, kind of the U.S. and its military complex, going in into communities in the U.S., but also going abroad, that this somehow is ordained by God. I mean, it's very scary. And that, these young organizers were not immune to all of these forces and all of this warped theology that's out there right now. But so that's why it was really important. And it was really powerful to have honest conversation about how, if we look at freedom movements across the world and in these United States, throughout history and today, there is a strong faith core to that work. And we can't just, kind of concede the Bible and theology and to these extremists.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about a vital aspect of keeping democracy alive, and that's young people. Our guest today is theologian, ordained minister, and anti poverty activist Liz Theo Harris, who is director of the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice, and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, a great organization. We're talking specifically about Young Organizers Boot Camp, and I can't help but think, you know, the exact black and white opposite of the Young Organizers Boot Camp is that happened during the 1930s in Germany that had a lot of appeal to young people, and that's the Hitler Youth. Mm. But that's, I wonder, you know, how different this is from that. How self-selecting it is, how representative of their peers you think it is, and what do you hope that they can teach their contemporaries?
Well, I mean, I get a lot of hope from the diversity of the young organizers that have come forward to be a part of this boot camp and this program. And, you know, I get the chance to travel around and speak on college campuses and just be in communities. And you know, I have been very heartened to meet lots of young people who are really leading the way in their communities and pushing back and rejecting the kind of racism and violence and hate and division of those that are in power in our society right now. And I think it's a great counter to, you know, any effort throughout history or today to recruit young people to kind of be the army, quote unquote, of extremism and of violence, and instead to bring people together, this like diverse cacophony of different people. Uh-huh. who are you know, really helping to organize and educate and teach and fight and learn and lead, you know, in communities right now in this moment.
I like that line: teach and fight and learn and lead.
That's right. I think that always educating and organizing go hand in hand, and that's, you know, particularly true when you get to do work among young people.
Were there specific ways, do you think, that the faith-based tradition can be carried on? What was specifically what was taught and learned regarding any new, perhaps timely methods to reclaim the power of faith traditions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think part of what folks were very interested in was one, reclaiming theology, you know, kind of, you know, reclaiming, wrestling away from the clutches of those that would say that, you know, that the Bible's all about law and order, when really what's at the absolute core is justice, justice for the marginalized, justice for those at the bottom. And so I think that was an important part of it. But I also think really reclaiming the ritual and the culture and the music and the space for kind of liturgy and prayer, not any particular kind of prayer, not with any particular doctrine, but not allowing a very small minority of people to say that they, you know, are the be all and all of what it is to be quote unquote Christian or religious in this society. Instead, you know, singing about, I mean, one of the songs that folks were singing throughout the week was, you know, we have a good land below us and wild waters all around, and the whole sky is always on our side, right? And so it's just, you know, really reminding people that that, you know, from whatever faith tradition you come from, or not a faith tradition at all, but this kind of arc of the universe bending towards justice, and us needing to bend it that way, and that when we do so, something much bigger than ourselves is there with us on our side.
I wonder if the two sides can be civil with one another, the Turning Point USA and the people from the Young Organizers Boot Camp, who are both faith-oriented, can sit down and have a discussion. I wonder if there's any, was there any talk about talking with the people on the other side and connecting about the true nature of the Christian faith?
Well, I do think that people are talking to people with different points of view and different positions all the time. And, you know, in fact, are trying to get really good at what does it look like to talk across difference. I think there's something different, though, of doing that versus trying to win a very hardened group of people who like are not interested in that kind of conversation or dialogue. You know, I think if we look at the kind of demographics of the country right now, and we, for instance, even think about the 90 million people that didn't vote in the last election.
Wow.
Like, you know, that's a lot of people. And if you add those 90 million plus, you know, the millions that voted, you know, and with concerns around healthcare and good jobs and enter racism. And then you also think about, you know, I think some 10 million or so that did vote for this current president. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking so many people who actually see there's a lot of diversity, there's a lot of difference, but also, you know, those folks that just, you know, believe we should be a nation that welcomes immigrants and believes we should be a nation that, you know, puts people first and that, you know, makes sure that people have health care and housing and all of their needs being met. I mean, that the just trying to organize and unify those hundreds of millions of people. I mean, there's about 200 million people in this country right now that are having trouble making ends meet. And that are living in constant crisis, right? Like, what does it look like for us to, you know, talking across the difference of that 200 million, not so much just trying to win some folks that are pretty hardened in their positions over to a different view, though we can do that too, and people are doing that too, and having success, but there also is something about not giving in to the fact that there might be certain people in power right now, but people do not agree with what they're doing. And that's in huge numbers. That's the case.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about a Young Organizers Boot Camp and young people getting together to go against the dominant paradigm right now. Our guest today is Liz Theo Harris, a theologian and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. The Young Organizers Boot Camp comes out of actually a long, kind of proud American tradition of camps getting together and working on making social and political and cultural change. Tell us, please, about its long-ago predecessor, the Highland Fold School. What was that all about, and how effective was that to the movement in general?
Yeah, for anyone that hasn't heard of the Highlander Folk School, I mean, it was a training ground. It was established by Don West and Miles Horton. They were actually seminarians at Union Theological Seminary, where I still teach in New York City, you know, many years ago. And they learned about this kind of folk school tradition that came out of different Scandinavian countries. They were from Appalachia, from kind of working class families. They went back home and said, let's open up like kind of a training grounds for folks that want to do justice. And so the Highlander Folk School was at first really a training grounds for the industrial union movement before the AFL-CIO had a kind of political education arm. And in fact, part of what happens, how the Highlander Folk School transitions from just supporting the CIO organizing and these labor unions organizing is as they are able to start doing their own political education, it frees up Highlander and Miles Horton and others. to then become really the training ground for the Black freedom struggle and the civil rights movement. You know, Highlander is where Dr. King spends time, where Rosa Parks is just weeks before the Montgomery bus boycott. She's there because already at the time she's a secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery. In the Black freedom struggle, it was a cross-racial school in the South, in the rural South. And so it was a place where also the citizenship schools, where Septima Clark and others, really advanced a kind of political education that also allowed Black folk to be able to register and pass those draconian tests that existed as a way to suppress voting rights.
Right.
Highlander was where We Shall Overcome, this kind of anthem of the movement, comes from and is spread. So there's all these things that are happening at Highlander in Tennessee in the 50s and in the 60s. And it has continued today. I mean, it's now called the Highlander Education Center. It's still in Tennessee, kind of not that far from where Haley Farm is. There's still powerful movement building work happening out of place over the past 30 plus years that I've been involved in social movement activity. Mm-hmm. I've been at Highlander umpteen times, connecting up with different grassroots movement building groups. But those foothills of the mountains right there in Tennessee are those Smoky Mountains, really it has birthed a lot of powerful education and organizing and kind of been a space for people to commit to a long struggle for justice.
And it is a long struggle. It, as Dr. King said, it's the arc of history turns slowly toward justice. It is slow and it takes our effort. It doesn't happen all by itself, that's for sure. Young people, they like to get involved in things like this. I imagine, getting together with other young people to talk about politics and culture and have fun. And there's the social aspect of it as well, which I'm sure is attractive to a lot of people. But young people don't get so involved in electoral activities nearly so much as movements. I mean, I remember going to Bernie Sanders events and they're filled with young people. But my question later on was, what percentage of them bothered to vote? I don't even know. Can you explain why that is and why what we're talking about here is so much more powerful with young people?
Well, I think that, I think young people are able to see that so many of our politicians today, and this has been the case for decades now, are not speaking to the needs and concerns and demands of people, especially young folks who are disproportionately low income, who are disproportionately without health care, who are disproportionately working jobs that do not make a living wage. And, we have year after year, election after election, where these politicians, kind of refuse to take up these issues. I mean, where you can counter this, and you can see something very different, and you can actually imagine how and why young people could get involved in voting and in elections more, is the case of someone like Zohran Mamdani in New York City, where
yes,
I live.
Yes.
And if we look at some of the facts and figures that come out of that, the demographics of who both helped to volunteer and organize that campaign, and also who turns out and votes, and who then celebrated that victory, it's so many young people. And in fact, if there was this map that was published, in the New York Times, right after the election, this was true in the primary, but then also in the general election. And it showed how just there was this incredible surge of new voters that were mostly young, from communities all across the city. And so it shows that if politicians are actually talking about the kinds of things, putting forward the kinds of solutions that young people need, folks will actually turn out and vote, will actually engage in elections, and get involved politically otherwise as well. But as long as, you know, these politicians don't take up the kind of demands and the issues that matter the most, then that leads to kind of, you know, on top of the already kind of voter suppression tactics that that are being used, you know, in states all across the country. But I mean, to me, Mandami's victory and some of these other electoral victories that have happened since, you know, really show that young people will turn out when they have something to vote for, not just vote against.
Yes, they do. And I can remember the great feeling of when I was involved as a young person, when my candidate won. It's almost like a drug, you know. You get this feeling for, wow, this is fun. This is a unique feeling. You don't get this anywhere else. And winning with Zoran Mandami, and I imagine with AOC and perhaps some others, if candidates can actually talk to the issues that we're talking about here, they really can win. And I'm reminded of a quote from Texas Agriculture Commissioner Jim Hightower, who said, in Texas, there's two things in the middle of the road. You probably know what I'm about to say, dead armadillos and yellow stripes. And that doesn't work. Often, election campaigns, they're often top-down affairs. You know, the movements offer something unique for the individual. Can you tell us about that?
I mean, I think movements, when they're successful, are always bottom-up, right?
People,
not just deciding that something is a good idea, but being compelled to act. Right, having no choice but to push, seeing that, like, you know, no one's coming to save us, but so therefore we're going to organize, whether it's for voting rights or whether it's for, you know, clean air or whether it's for healthcare or just so many of the things that impact people. And so I think, you know, movements are about lots of people being compelled to. You know, to act in ways that will make their lives and their neighbors and communities' lives better, and then starting to see the impact that it has, that they have, and continuing it along the way. And I think that, you know, again, if we look at successful transformative change in history or today, you have this ground up organizing, this
yes,
with so many people, you know, being inspired and compelled to push back and do something different.
I think if you look at history, one will find that movements from the ground up work. They don't necessarily work nearly as well if they're from the top down. And the Democratic Party seems to have a hard time learning that. As you point out, Generation Z, Gen Z and Gen Alpha, I'm not even sure what the heck they are projected to be distinctly worse off than their parents. Youths make up about 2 in 5 recipients of this Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or food stamps. As the Trump regime erodes that program, what happens to the young people from the effects of that being eroded more than it does affect older people?
Well, I mean, I think, again, you know, right now everyone's hurting in this country, but in particular, young people are. You know, folks that are coming of age or haven't yet, you know, their prospects are not looking good right now, whether that's war or whether that's violence or whether that's, you know, their economic prospects, or whether it's, are we going to have an earth that actually, you know, allows people to breathe clean air and drink clean water. I mean, these are existential concerns. They're not just like issues. They're really matters of life and death, and whose lives and whose deaths are going to be, you know, advanced are predominantly young people. And so I just think, everyone is hurting right now. But in particular, young people are. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, I think this is part of the point. You know, we, over the last, you know, year, we're about to have our first trillionaire. I mean, like there's the kind of capturing of so much power and so much wealth in the hands of so few people. I mean, I was reading a couple of statistics the other day. I mean, for one, a 1/1000th of a percent of people in the world right now control more wealth than half of the world's population. I mean, how can you, I can't even understand how small a number, 1/1000th of a percent, you know, we're talking like 50, 60 people. And then compared to billions and billions of people. I also read this other statistic, which is that rich people are 4,000 times more likely to run for office than lower income people, right? I mean, 4,000 times. I mean, is this a democracy? I mean, if basically you can buy your way into anything, you know, it's not. And again, who feels the brunt of that in particular are young people.
So then, you know, as you say, running for office takes a great deal of money, much more money than it ever was when I was running for office. And being a young person and working with other people and building a movement, it doesn't take anything. It doesn't take any money at all. It's a lot more attractive, I would think. And it has a powerful effect. I mean, high school kids from all over this state and other states are staging walkouts against ICE. Some people might say, oh, what a waste of time, they're just skipping class. What do you think? Does this have any effect?
I mean, I think, of course, it has an effect. I mean, to when you have such violence happening, to then get to witness the power of a no to that violence, right? You know, like, this is not okay with us. And that's a place that movements start, right? You have to start with a no. You have to start with, this isn't okay. Not on our watch. Like, business as usual is not okay. I mean, because otherwise you start to imagine that, you know, yes, things are bad and these powerful people are doing, you know, are abusing young people and doing all these other things, but no one really cares. But when, you know, students in high schools and at colleges and even at middle schools, you know, stage these walkouts, when young people are out there on the streets, you know, singing and praying with their feet and marching, you know, I think it really sends a message that that this next generation is very hopeful, and they're not just going to lay down and allow for injustice to happen. They're gonna make sure that they're there in the numbers, you know, as the saints go marching in, and making sure that we build a society that welcomes everybody.
I almost hate to say this, but my parents, I was lucky enough to grow up with liberal democratic parents, McGovern type people. In fact, they were McGovern supporters, and they had great hope for my generation, the baby boomers. And I wonder now, I mean, my guess is only about 15% of us who went to Woodstock really cared about making political and social change. I wonder about your sense of what that percentage is now.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure I know the percentage.
No, just a gut feeling.
I mean, of how many people?
Of young people who are concerned about making political and social change. This generation, say you have 1,000 people, young people, about how many of them do you think really do care about this and want to do something about it?
I mean, again, if we judge from Mondami's election, or if we look at, you know, who's participating in these protests around ICE, I mean, we're talking, you know, the majority of young people are not okay with how things are going.
That's good to hear.
And yeah, it is.
You say avenues of traditional politics feel inaccessible as a means of addressing so many of the problems, and where accessible regularly proved critically insufficient. This is a key point. I wonder if you could say more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I think we're seeing this in this administration anyways, right? Kind of rule of law and the more traditional ways of affecting change, whether it's through advocacy or, laws and legislation. I mean, these pieces are not necessarily the levers of power that are being used right now. If someone goes to the Supreme Court, more or less it goes with a very partisan line. In the legislature right now, in Congress, you have a majority who is just keeps on making decisions that go against the will of people, right? And so I think that some of these more traditional levers of power are not necessarily the ones that people are able to exercise, and in particular young people, again, because they're poorer, because they have less access to other kinds of resources. And so I think that's why people are being so creative in the kinds of ways that they're showing up and organizing. And again, I think that we're seeing that in street protests, we're seeing that in these insurgent campaigns of like someone like Mamdani, where I think we're seeing it in some of these other
other races that are going on.
And
there's also this wonderful bridge brigade thing. I don't know if they have that in New York City where you are, but here in the somewhat country, there are people that go up on bridges and hold signs against ICE, mm-hmm. and it's kind of fun. I wonder, is it somewhat unique to young people that they feel a sense of interconnectedness?
I mean, I do think that young people do feel interconnected because they are, right? I think
true.
It's people understand that their very survival is contingent on the survival of the planet and an ending of wars. I mean, people can understand that who they are and how they can express being that matters and is connected to someone else's culture and survival as well. And so I think that I think those connections are being made because they're so clear. I mean, and I was getting to facilitate a panel at this young organizers boot camp, and there were all of these young people that are leading big things in their communities. And there was a young woman who was leading an abortion fund and sitting next to someone who's organizing against family and child detention. And they were able to make all kinds of connections and see the interconnections between the right for bodily autonomy and the separation of children from their immigrant parents. It wasn't a big leap. It wasn't difficult or complex to see that that this kind of criminalization theme, this kind of separating and breaking up families and communities theme, the kind of way that just the forces of power are marginalizing and clamping down on people. And so people are able to see those connections and then therefore build alliances in these new and exciting ways.
Well, this is exciting to hear, I must say, that young people are getting together and uniting, and you think it's a majority. I think that's wonderful to hear. I'm not surprised. Our guest has been Liz Theo Harris, a theologian and ordained minister, anti-poverty activist, director of the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice, and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Again, what's that website for the Kairos Center?
Yep, it's Kairos, KairosCenter.org. And folks can find us on the social media as well.
the Young Organizers Boot Camp. How exciting. Very enthusiastic and hopeful. Dare I say hopeful? Whoa, imagine that. Hopeful. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for all the work you do.
All right, you too. Thank you. Bye.
All right, take care. Bye.
She wants a young American.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free.
And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe.
It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the